This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
All right, welcome in. Second hour of the program. Wes Reynolds is going to join us at the bottom of this hour. We'll talk a little golf. I mean, there's a tournament this weekend, but we'll recap the U.S. Open, and we'll talk a little football as well, as Wes is my co-host on Opening Lines every Sunday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Pacific time here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. We'll also get back to the NBA in a couple of minutes. I should say 20. NBA Eastern Conference Finals perspective coming up in our next block. But Adam Hill is nice enough to give us a couple of minutes. Raiders writer, Las Vegas Review Journal, covers the National Football League for the LVRJ as well, and was down there last night over at the Al/Death Star/Roomba. Adam, let's start with, there's a lot to start with. Let's start with a fun topic. Drew Brees looks pretty old, huh?
I mean, his arm does. Yeah, for sure. I mean, to see it in person, it was troubling. And I don't know how much, you know, I didn't get to see the whole game last week. It showed up there. The couple of highlights I saw, he looked okay. But I think the combination of not having Michael Thomas and the fact that his arm strength is, you know, seriously depleted gave me some concern. This is a team that I thought could be in the Super Bowl. I picked him to be in the Super Bowl. I'm very much questioning now only because of Drew Brees.
Some of the numbers from Brees last night: 33% of his passing yards came through the air, according to Pro Football Focus. He was 5-9 on passes 10 or more yards downfield. He only had one attempt 20 or more yards downfield, and he didn't complete it. And through two games now, Brees 4.82 air yards on his passes through two games, the lowest by any quarterback through two games since Brett Favre in 2009. That one via ESPN Stats and Info. So I'm curious from the other side of this, because we were going over some of the offensive numbers for the Raiders last night, Adam, and they weren't the most efficient when you looked at like yards per play, yards per pass, yards per rush, but they were just grinding them out. They were just converting third downs at a really high clip. What'd you make of New Orleans defense? Because I found from like a numerical standpoint, like they actually were pretty impressive if you looked at the averages, but my eye last night watching like them get key first downs on third and tens on the ground, the Raiders, like certain situations, the defense didn't seem like it was playing very well when you watched it, but the numbers showed that they actually weren't that bad.
Yeah, that's one, because I think, you know, I like you looking at all those numbers, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of obsessing over them all the time. But then you actually watched the game last night, and I thought the Raiders offense was really, really impressive. Right. It didn't do the things I want to see them do. They didn't take shots down the field. That's one of the things I'm always harping on, and a lot of people that, you know, analyze this offense are always harping on. No deep shots, no real chances, none of that. But New Orleans never really did anything to stop them from just saying, okay, we're going to run for 4 yards on first down, run for 3 yards on second down, and then we'll find a way to, you know, complete a pass for 4 yards on third down. And the Raiders did that over and over again. And, you know, I think the percentages, the numbers will tell you that eventually you're going to make stops on that, right? Like all these third downs are not going to be converted. But they were. They just kept converting every single third down. And, you know, if a team doesn't stop you from doing what you want to do, you just keep doing it. And that's what the Raiders did, to their credit yesterday. They weren't going to change what they were doing because it was working, and the Saints didn't do anything to make them stop it. So the Raiders kept doing it. And I thought it was really impressive that the Raiders were able to stay within themselves and just kind of grind out offense the way that they wanted to do it. And, you know, in the end, it was way more than enough.
Yeah, the fact that you faced 17 third downs tells me that like first and second down weren't overly efficient. Right. But the fact that you kept grinding them out were absolutely nuts. So let me ask this on the other side of it, right? Because we open up at Drew Brees' age, you know, and let's go back to this whole numbers thing, because there were some things when you looked at this from an off or defensive standpoint for the Raiders, Adam, 7.4 yards per play for the Saints, 424 total yards. By the eye test, by the way, opening up massive holes up front for Alvin Kamara to run through. This defense through 2 weeks, I still haven't been sold on that. Am I wrong after watching last night and thinking like, yeah, like the mistakes the Saints were making outside of Drew Brees' age, they were really shooting themselves in the foot, because offensively, when they put drives together, they were running down the field in short drives as well.
And real quick, just on the Raiders again, to finish that off.
Yeah.
As much as I don't think the numbers have told us that they've been very good, and, you know, watching it, I'm not, you know, blown away by them. Like I said, I was much more impressed last night than I was last week. But here's the thing: 34 points in back-to-back games. That just doesn't happen very often. So even though, you know, we want to sit here and say, well, I still question this. You can't question the productivity, and that's 34 points in back-to-back games, which has only happened twice in Raiders history. Twice, 67 and 68. I think
Seriously?
We're going two times that they scored. Yeah, that they scored 30. And they went to the Super Bowl and the AFL Championship game in those 2 years, and they have not done that since. So I have to think that, you know, that's a very impressive part of this. And on the Saints side, defensively for the Raiders, listen, I thought the Raiders defense was atrocious in week one. I thought it was awful, and I thought they'd be exposed a little bit yesterday. But here, let me give them credit for this. The first quarter yesterday, the Raiders defense was pretty bad, and it was more of the same from last week. It was, yep, just like we thought, everything that we thought was wrong with their victory is now showing up. The Saints are just gashing them. In the first quarter, they just ran all over them. 86 yards, the Saints racked up. In the first quarter on the ground, that was the most the Raiders had given up on the ground in a first quarter since 2008. So they were just run all over. But credit to the Raiders and their defensive coordinator, Paul Gunther, because they adjusted. And one of the things they adjusted to was after the first quarter, they said, I don't think this guy can beat us, this guy being Breeze. Like, I don't think he can beat us. Let's see. So they adjusted, loaded up the box, took away the run, and tried to make Breeze beat, you know, tried to tell Breeze, hey, you're going to have to beat us downfield if you want to beat us. And he couldn't do it. And so it went from 86 in the first quarter to, I think, less than 40 the rest of the game for the Saints. I don't have the notes in front of me, but it got much better for the Raiders against the run and against the pass. They were saying, hey, if you want to throw these little short passes, go ahead. We're just going to keep everything in front of us and make tackles. And they were able to do that. And I think one of the things the Saints rely on is, hey, if you try that, we're going to throw it to Alvin Kamara underneath, and he's going to turn a 4-yard pass into a 30-yard pass. And the Raiders made their tackles. So, you know, they kept everything in front of them. They said, if you want to complete it, go ahead, and we'll stop you. And eventually they did. And, you know, credit to the Raiders for making that adjustment.
What did you think of Gruden's decision to kick the field goal to ice the game, essentially?
Didn't love it, obviously. Listen, I'm not going to be a results-based thinker, because I hate that more than anything, and just say, hey, it worked. What's the difference? It worked. Well, next time it might not, and you might cost yourself by doing that. I think... based on the game situation and knowing that the Saints had a hard time. Now, they had just put together a really good drive just before that, straight down the field. And so thinking that, but if you punt it, you pin them inside the 20, and AJ Cole's been really good at pinning people inside the 20, especially from where they were. You pin them inside the 20 with no timeouts and less than a minute left. Chances are it's going to be really tough to drive down the score. Now, you kick the field goal and make it, and there's a 54-yard field goal for those that weren't watching. A 54-yard field goal with a minute left with a kicker who made a 54-yarder last week but had never done that before in his career. I think, you know, you miss that, and you're giving the Saints the ball at midfield down 7, you're probably in some trouble. And so it was risky for sure, and I think, you know, the numbers of the game would probably tell you it might have been the wrong decision. John Gruden went old school with his gut, which I hate. It's never been my gut told me to do this. I don't care what the numbers say. That is really a dumb way to run a team to me. But John Gruden has been there and I haven't, so you got to give him a little bit of credit for that, I suppose. And he said he looked in the kicker's eye, Daniel Carlson, and something told him, hey, this guy is ready to win the game for me. Okay, I guess if that's how we're going to do things. And listen, he was right, so you kind of look foolish arguing with him, but I don't think it's a decision that I would have made.
I loved the argument. He tells his kicker that he's confident in him when he sends him out there to hit that. I'm like, all right, cool. So if he misses it and Drew Brees gets it at the 44, at least he can walk off knowing John Gruden has confidence in me.
Yeah. I showed confidence in my kicker. He'll appreciate that going forward. Also, John Gruden also said, hey, new stadium, fresh surface, nothing getting in our way, no divots, no weird spots on the field because it's brand new. I thought it was smooth and he was going to go out and make it. Well, okay. I guess we'll go with it.
Nope, results. He got it. Doesn't matter. All right, let's spin this forward then. Sure. Am I wrong in thinking, I really think this is a good spot for New England next week. 6.5 at the open. Now they're laying 6 at home against the Raiders. Short week, right? Monday night. Then you got to go all the way to the East Coast. All the numbers that we have brought up with the Raiders defense up to this point as well. I liked what I've seen out of New England offensively through 2 games. What do you make of the spot next week on the road for the Raiders?
Yeah, I think it's a really good spot for New England too, for all the reasons that you said. Now, you know, the caveat would be New England had to travel to the West Coast as well, but they did get the extra day to fly home. I loved what I saw in New England's offense for sure. The defense left a lot to be desired, but I don't think Derek Carr is Russell Wilson, although he has been operating at a really, really high level the first couple of weeks. I think the Patriots find a way to figure that out, especially with the one extra day of prep. Which makes it more difficult. But if you want to look at the, emotional aspect of things, which again, I usually don't, but hey, if Gruden's talking about looking at guys' eyes and determining things, and why do we not look at their emotions? The Patriots, I think, poured a lot into that game on Sunday.
Yeah.
And that was one that they really seemed to want to make a statement, and they really wanted to win, and they fell short. And I think sometimes when that happens, it takes a lot out of you. Now, we could also be sitting here Monday morning and saying, wow, the Patriots really took out their frustration on the Raiders. I think those things could go either way, but there is a possibility that they, have a little bit of a letdown after pouring so much into trying to win that game on Sunday and falling just short in the way that they did and get a tackle on the 1 yard line. That is not an easy way to end a game. But it also could fire them up. So I think we can pretty much ignore that aspect of it.
What about some initial reads injury-wise for Las Vegas going forward? Abram, of course, injured himself. There was a whole thing with the camera early in the game, banged up along the offensive line. So what is the status of some of the bodies that are ailing for Las Vegas?
Yeah, well, Abram, I think based on the aftermath of hitting that cart, is dead.
Yeah.
You see him just laying there.
What a waste of a first-round pick.
Yeah, he came back in. He was fine. I think a lot of people asked me, like, dude, is he okay? He looked like it was like paralyzed. I said, well, I think more than anything, I think he was just terrified. Last year, Monday Night Football, first game of the season, he got hurt and missed the whole season. And it was a similar play along the sideline. So I think you just lay there like, oh my God, this just happened again. I think that was more fear than anything else that he suffered from. And he looks like to be okay. The offensive line is the bigger concern. Last week, they lost Trent Brown and Sam Young, their starter and their backup, within a couple of plays of each other in the first quarter. Denzel Good filled in the rest of the way. A guard by trade, filled in a tackle, and he played fine. Yesterday, they lose Richie Incognito in the first quarter. He went in the game questionable with an Achilles issue. He aggravated it, went down. We're still waiting to hear results of that. But John Simpson, a rookie who they didn't have a lot of faith in being able to step in right away, he stepped in, struggled his first couple of possessions, and then really settled in and played well. So I don't think there was much concern there. The defensive side of the ball, Nick Kwiatkowski, he's a kind of the captain of the defense. He missed yesterday's game, but there was fear he'd be out the year. It doesn't look like it's that severe. He should be back. So injury-wise, the offensive line is still a question mark, but they showed a lot of ability last year to fill in on offensive line injuries, so I don't think they're too worried about that, although the more that you have to fill in, the tougher it becomes, obviously. So if they lose anybody else on that offensive line, that could be a real challenge. But they've done a good job filling in so far. They haven't really had too many other issues outside of that.
Yep. So Raiders, again, catching 6 on the road next week in New England. That is a morning game, total 48 between these two clubs on Sunday. All right, man. Hey, before we get you out of here, anything on the NFL card next week that has stuck out to you at all? I know that you and I were talking over the weekend that we might have a mutual love for Cleveland maybe being underrated in the big picture, but do you have anything on the card that has stuck out to you from a side or total perspective for Sunday?
Dude, I have not gotten too much of my handicapping this. Monday Night Football really threw me off this week, so I haven't really dug into the numbers at all yet. I will just say that I'm extremely excited to watch Baltimore, Kansas City. I think that is going to be unbelievable.
Yep. Baltimore 3.5 or 3, total 53.5. Adam Hill, you can follow him on Twitter at Adam Hill LVRJ. There it is. At Adam Hill LVRJ up on social media. Adam, thanks for the time, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for reading my bio and learning about me, John. That was very cool of you.
You're welcome. Anytime. I do it for all my guests, by the way.
Yeah.
Thanks, Adam. All right, we'll move on from that. And I think it is, when you look at it from the Raiders' perspective as well going forward, Adam brings up a great point that we did not consider in the first hour, of course, which is that the New England Patriots did pour a lot into that Sunday night game against the Seattle Seahawks. And you could tell that there was a, and there's always a desire for these NFL teams to win, but from an anecdotal standpoint, really trying hard and pressing to get that win and kind of show that this offense and this team overall has a very, very good base that they can move forward with here. But you see the Raiders going forward, that is not the correct schedule, so we'll have to fix that. But the Raiders going forward here, it's a tough spot to go back to the East Coast here after a big emotional win themselves on a short week and get ready for a very well-coached New England Patriots team who has a Cam Newton, or excuse me, a quarterback in Cam Newton who could take advantage of some of the weaknesses that the Raiders defense has to offer here. All right, when we come back, we're going to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. Miami and Boston. I cannot wait to see what is going to happen as this series continues tomorrow. Remember, they took the day off because of Monday Night Football. Also means that a guy like Gordon Hayward, who also got a game under his belt, gets to get a little healthier for this series. But here's the thing. Eric Spoelstra, I think he made a small mistake here in game three. And we're going to tell you what that is, because it was actually something he had been using that had really worked very well against Boston. It's actually a big reason why they had opened up a 2-0 series lead over the Celtics. We'll talk about that and what we might see here for game four. How'd your football betting go this weekend? As you know, there's always room to improve your sports betting IQ. VSiN is here to help you bet smarter this season. Start your 7-day risk-free trial. Place your next bet with confidence. Sign up today. You'll get Points Spread Weekly, our digital betting guide with NFL power ratings and consensus picks from our experts. 24/7 live video stream, full replays of all VSiN's shows, the college football betting guide with previews, predictions, and betting strategy. Plus, you can always access our parlay calculator, prop bet search engine, and pick tracker on VSiN.com. Visit VSiN.com/subscribe. Start your risk-free trial today. That is VSiN.com/subscribe. All right, let's change gears here. Let's go to the NBA. So Western Conference Finals, of course, later tonight. We'll see if the Denver Nuggets can take one, cut that deficit in half, or will they be staring at a 3-0 series hole as we head into Wednesday. But the Eastern Conference Finals, of course, are still going on, despite the fact that we have not seen them for quite a few days. The Boston Celtics and the Miami Heat. So Boston right now, 3-point favorite, total 210.5, depending on where you look. Get the last game 117-106 over the Miami Heat. They close as a 3.5-point favorite, total at 208.5. Two of the three games in this series have gone over the total, so we're starting to see this total tick up a little bit. 209, 208, and 208.5 were the three closing totals for this series in the first three games. So I've brought this up a lot, and going into game three, was pretty confident before we talked about this with the Gordon Hayward news that, look, we talk about why numbers move and why they get to the point where they do. And game two closes Celtics as a 3-point favorite. Game three closed 3.5. The difference between those two, of course, is that Gordon Hayward was actually on the floor for the Boston Celtics. You can understand a change. You can understand a change in the power rating. You can understand the betting market. Probably upping the rating on a Celtics team who finally gets back one of their key pieces and they get a little bit deeper. Going forward here, though, what I'm really curious about is a couple of things. One, from the Heat perspective, this is something that I talked about earlier today with Gil and his show, Numbers Game. This is a very important point for the Miami Heat going forward. We have a lot of numbers to back it up, too. Boston in that struggle versus the zone defense. And why I bring this up again is the fact that Miami seemed to go away from that in game three and were content with playing man against the Boston Celtics, and it didn't work out for them. And they end up losing the game and potentially a chance to take a 3-0 series lead over the Boston Celtics. You would think that Miami, who led the regular season in terms of teams frequently using zone defense, they were the top of the league, and used it quite a bit in the first two games, would come back to this here for game four when we finally see them on Wednesday and that this is going to be in the arsenal yet again for the Miami Heat, considering the struggles that the Boston Celtics have had against this zone defense that the Miami Heat have run. And by the way, which has been pretty crazy about their struggles against the zone defense, is the fact that it's not like a Nick Nurse type situation where Nurse is switching it up, going box and one, 1-2-2, whatever. He's actually just throwing out Spoelstra 3-2 and saying, beat us with this on the floor. And the Celtics haven't been able to do that. Now, having said that, the change, right? Gordon Hayward being on the floor, what change does that make? And, you know, Jacob, I'll ask you this. I think what we saw in that last game was that the ball movement was much better. Boston has a tendency to go isolation heavy. Their offense at times is kind of like a take turns type of deal, right? Kemba, you creating some space. Jason, you creating some space. Jalen, you creating some space and get your shots and make it work. Boston has the better shot creators. Miami has the better ball sharing team. And I don't think it's any coincidence that Gordon Hayward is finally healthy. He finally sees the floor. And all of a sudden in the series, at least, you see the highest assist total that Boston has posted against the Miami Heat because the ball was moving a little bit more. You think it's a fair observation?
Absolutely. Gordon Hayward is probably one of the top guys in the league when it comes to hockey assists in the NBA.
100%, right? And it's just that first pass that initiates the offense that ultimately ends in a scoring possession. And that's what I think the big difference was here. And it helps so much, right, to have the, we'll call him the hockey assister, especially against zone defenses too, which is why I'm really curious about this matchup going forward, is if the ball movement's better for Boston, even if they throw Miami the zone back out there, you should be able to then beat it if your ball movement's going to be a little bit better and you can be able to find this and maybe either shoot them out of it or find some guy in the middle of some open space and start to break them out of the zone if they break it back out. But Hayward coming back changes things for Boston, and it's obviously changing them for the better. And I wonder if this is going to be the change that Boston needed to get back in this series and potentially win it over the Miami Heat. Because I thought going into this series that it was not a very good matchup for Miami for a couple of reasons. And now that Boston is fully healthy, and now that, again, you get this extra day because they didn't want to go head-to-head with the NFL, this only helps Boston in that regard. So I do wonder if this change, because we're always looking for change and why the market changes on these numbers, what it means for Boston and if it's going to be a positive change. And I'll say this too, you know, before we knew about the like full health and what Gordon Hayward brought to the table, and even from a scoring perspective, wasn't all there, the number did close 3.5 for Boston. So if you like Miami, I would say hold out, because I think you're going to be able to get your 3.5 here for game four, but I wonder if you're going to be able to get four, because the market has not been shy on pumping this number up on Boston, even though they are, you know, in this 1-2 or 2-1 series deficit against the Heat. All right, we roll on here. Wes Reynolds is going to join us on the other side. We'll get back to the National Football League, continue to look at some of the numbers and the key injuries for week three. It's The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Welcome back in. Last half of the second hour here on The Edge. If you missed out on any part of the program, VSiN.com/podcasts. Good first hour. A lot of football talk, of course, as we recap Monday Night Football, look ahead to the Western Conference Finals later tonight. And we had our good preview of the Eastern Conference Finals just a few minutes ago. You go ahead, look that up at VSiN.com/podcasts. More on the ECF tomorrow as it will get back underway for game four. Let's take a look at the National Football League, though. A couple more games to just initially set the table for in week three of the NFL. The first of which is, actually, we've seen quite the line move already early on in this matchup. Pittsburgh Steelers look ahead line against the Houston Texans. Opened up again last week, Pittsburgh 6 with the total posted after week 2 at 45. But initially a 6-point favorite for the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are now a 4-point favorite against the Houston Texans. Total hasn't budged really, dipped to 44.5. We're coming back up to 45. But this is quite the adjustment. And the Steelers actually, for a good chunk, were a 3.5-point favorite. So the market coming in hard on Houston. And I'm going to get to some of the defensive numbers and the things that I have not liked from the Houston Texans. But overall, it seemed like a buy-low spot here for Houston going forward against this team in the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, some of the defensive numbers that worry you through two games, right, for the Houston Texans. For example, the matchup with the Baltimore Ravens this past Sunday, where they give up 230 yards on 37 carries, 6.2 yards per attempt, 33 points, of course, and really kind of like a weird and slow and odd game for the Baltimore Ravens, who were not really electric, but still came out there comfortably against the Houston Texans. And honestly, it was kind of reminiscent of the Thursday night matchup against Kansas City, where Kansas City was not their same electric self offensively, but just pounded the ball into the dirt against them. And that has been the consistent issue with Houston through two games, because you look at what Clyde Edwards-Helaire and the Kansas City Chiefs did in week one against the Texans, and you see 34 rushes, 166 yards, and a touchdown on the ground. Edwards-Helaire, of course, responsible for 138 and 5.5 per carry. This is now through two games a consistent issue with Houston. The fact that they haven't been very good against the run here through two games. And defensively, they just haven't been very good, period. If you look at from a secondary perspective, Thursday night, 24-32, 211, 6.6 yards per attempt against the Chiefs. Not very great, but three touchdowns for Patrick Mahomes in that game. Also had another one dropped. And Lamar Jackson, again, not insanely effective through the air, but still 18-24, 8.5 per attempt, threw a touchdown, not intercepted at all either. And this secondary was the worry for me with the Houston Texans, but now this front seven is starting to emerge as kind of a problem. Here's the thing, though. Against the Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, I think the Steelers coming into this, again, a team that I think we look at it is undefeated up to this point, but you still have some real question marks. To take, for example, their game against the Denver Broncos, where they barely get out 26-21. Jeff Driscoll comes in relief of Drew Lock and is actually insanely effective. 18-34, 256, 7.5 per attempt, two touchdowns. Did some really good things against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And even from a rushing standpoint, Melvin Gordon and company, 19-70 for Gordon, 3.7, but overall 26-104 and 4 yards per carry. The Pittsburgh Steelers, as good as that front seven is, I think from a standpoint of keeping teams in games, you know, they have done that through two games. Remember Monday night against the New York Giants, there's a very good case to be made that the Giants should have covered that game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And you look at overall, and I think there's just a little bit more to be desired from Pittsburgh in certain situations. They were 2-12 against the Denver Broncos on third downs. And while yards per attempt were solid at 6.4, you'd like to see more efficiency in key situations like third downs or in red zones, where they were just 1-for-3 in their three red zone possessions against the Denver Broncos. So I think from the perspective of laying 6 points with the Pittsburgh Steelers looking ahead to week three, that number was a little too high, considering what we've seen from the Pittsburgh Steelers not being able really to put teams away in, yes, covering a number like 6 in week one, but a game in which the New York Giants did everything possible not to cover that number, and the Steelers allowing them to hang around for the most part in that game. So thought 6 was high, now down to 4, 3.5. This seems more like the number, but this is also flying in the face, right? Not flying in the face. This is supporting the trend that I think a lot of times we see this. Teams that start the season 0-2 against the spread going forward now into week three, maybe usually a bet on spot for most of these teams. And it's mainly because right after 2 weeks, the power rating has shrunk a little bit. It's gotten a little bit weaker, and you can come in and find some value in certain spots with those teams. So the Texans fall into that category. I'm really curious because another team that falls into that category is the Cleveland Browns. And I think this is the Cleveland Browns team that probably should have covered Thursday night against the Cincinnati Bengals, a team that, again, kind of like the Pittsburgh Steelers, their mistakes allowed Cincinnati to stay within this number, right? The turnover by Baker Mayfield in the red zone, the fact that, you know, not that they went for it on fourth down, but that they didn't convert that fourth down on the 1 yard line. They were lucky, of course, for Myles Garrett to turn the ball over. They were able to punch it in a couple of plays later. But Cleveland, from the standpoint of mistakes, week one, it was a massive issue. Week two, it forced them not to cover. So now you look forward to week three against Washington. There's one matchup that I'm really intrigued by, and one that I think will work in Cleveland's favor, and that would be this offensive line taking on this front seven, because this offensive line through two games has been really good for the Cleveland Browns. They didn't lay a finger on Baker Mayfield on Thursday night, the Cincinnati Bengals, because this offensive line, from a pass protection standpoint, was really solid. He only got sacked twice against the Baltimore Ravens in week one. And from a run blocking standpoint, Kevin Stefanski's offense seemed to have taken hold here against the Cincinnati Bengals in week two. There was a lot more in terms of the run game. It was much more effective. And actually, I shouldn't even say much more effective, considering that against the Baltimore Ravens, the Cleveland Browns actually were able to generate some semblance of a running game. They just had to go away from it. But remember, they did average 5.1 yards per rush, 5.5 per attempt for Hunt, 6 flat for Chubb in that week one matchup, runs of 22 and 29 yards. So this running game has been really effective at times. And now you take on a Washington team that not only from a defensive standpoint has this front seven, but that's about it, man. Like, and I think this is an offensive line that can handle a pass rush that the Washington football team has. And you look at it from the offensive standpoint for Washington, we're coming off of a game in which they averaged just 5.3 yards per play. Week one, it was under 5 yards per play against the Philadelphia Eagles, a game they won by 10 points. So this offense from that standpoint has not been effective for Washington. And this has been the issue. Like, this is my issue with this team, is that this front seven is going to keep you in a lot of these games, but your offense at some point has to do something. And through 2 weeks, we have not seen much from the Washington football team in terms of efficiency from an offensive standpoint. And this is a good test for this Cleveland Browns team as well, because defensively, they had really big issues in the secondary against the Baltimore Ravens week one. Lamar Jackson tore him apart, had the most time to throw, of course, sliced and diced him to well over 10 yards per attempt. And then Joe Burrow comes in right on Thursday night and has a lot of success throwing against that secondary, made some really good passes, and ultimately on a final drive gets that team within the number. And this is a big litmus test for the Cleveland Browns secondary, because if you have your struggles against Dwayne Haskins and the Washington football team, then you have some really big issues as a defense moving forward that you have to fix. But I think from a value standpoint, look, if this number starts to get below seven, which I'm not sure it is, but I do think that Cleveland, they do fall under the umbrella, right, again, of the 0-2 ATS team going into week three. But I also just, I really hope, like, we saw this look-ahead line at 5.5, got dipped to below 4.5. I don't know if it's going to get there, but if this gets under a touchdown floating in the range of 6, I do think this Browns team is going to be worth a look against the Washington football team coming up next week. All right, Wes Reynolds is going to join us. We get his thoughts on what we saw at the U.S. Open over the weekend. Bryson DeChambeau just muscles and grunts his way through to a U.S. Open title. We'll also talk about his thoughts not only on what we saw in week 2, but we'll look ahead to week 3 with Wes, who, again, is the co-host on Opening Lines here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Wes Reynolds, he's a man of many hats, man of much talent, hosts Long Shots, helps out on the weekends in the Green Zone broadcasting from spots around town, also does the Opening Lines with me here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network, and he's with us now here on the program. Wes, what's up, my friend?
Hey, JVT, good to be with you. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. You know, it was another weekend of football, and you and I got a good look at what happened to week 2 and looked ahead to week 3, of course. I want to start with the NFL before we get to a little golf, and we'll talk about Big Buff Bryson and his major title. But when we looked at week 2 and spinning this into week 3, was there anything going forward, just general thoughts that you stuck with? Like, I was asked this question, for example, and I thought that we've seen through 2 weeks, Wes, that these teams with continuity along the coaching staff at core positions have found some success, right? Green Bay, Baltimore, right? Kansas City. These teams that retained a core of their being from a season ago have gotten off to very good starts.
Yeah, I absolutely right. And when you talked about that on Opening Lines on Sunday night, is that, look, the teams that we thought were going to be good before the season, the Baltimores, the Kansas City, they're as good as advertised, at least through 2 weeks. And then you get some 2-0 teams that you thought maybe would improve upon last year. Like you said, the continuity in the coaching staff, Seattle, Green Bay, maybe you can even throw Pittsburgh in, even though I think, you know, they've been not overly impressive, but you just figured getting Roethlisberger back that was going to at least improve him, because you know the defense is very good.
And how about Arizona, Wes?
What's that?
What about Arizona, too, right? Throw them in there?
Yeah, absolutely. The offense, Kyler Murray, who everybody thought when they looked at him as a rookie in preseason was like, oh, this guy can't play, and he is absolutely shattering those thoughts and those cynicisms from people. But back to what I was saying about some of the 2-0 teams, there's a couple that we don't know how good that they are yet, like our own team here in Las Vegas, the Raiders, now have to go to a tough spot and face New England off kind of a emotionally draining win, winning the first game in the new city against the Saints on Monday Night Football. So they're a team like that. I think the Bears at 2-0 might be a little bit fraudulent. We mentioned that game. Now you're starting to see 3.5 show on an 0-2 desperate Atlanta team. So look, some conclusions you can draw and then some are yet to be drawn.
So let's take a look at some of these specific teams and going forward into week three and some of these matchups. You know, we were just discussing Washington and Cleveland going forward, and Cleveland falls into that 0-2 ATS going into week three trend that a lot of people like to follow. Teams that are 0-2 ATS first 2 weeks, kind of in a bet on spot going into week three. What do you make of Cleveland through 2 weeks in this matchup against Washington?
Yeah, this is actually a tough game for me to call, because I do think, even though it's very early returns, I do think obviously Stefanski is at least a slight upgrade over Freddie Kitchens. That doesn't take much, but still a slight upgrade. This would be a game that would probably be a teaser candidate for me. Nope. Washington's defense, I think, is very good, but I'm still not a believer. Arizona, I think, maybe let their foot off the gas a little bit, and Washington was able to move the ball in the second half. But that offense is still very much a work in progress. And I think this potentially could be a good spot for Cleveland. I don't know if I'm going to lay the 7 yet, but that's certainly going to be on some teasers on Sunday.
How about that Pittsburgh team you were talking about? So the look-ahead line was Pittsburgh 6, now down to 4. It reached 3.5 over at the Westgate yesterday before getting back up here. It seems like, and again, by the way, Houston, one of those teams 0-2 against the spread going into week 3. You know, I think Pittsburgh is one of those teams you kind of alluded to, right? Through two games, you're not sure what you've gotten. And against two lesser opponents, West, they've kind of let both teams hang around. I think the Giants should have covered it week 1, and the Broncos, of course, stuck within that number yesterday or on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm actually not surprised to see Houston take a little bit of the money early, at least, because the desperate team 0-2, and that's a nightmare schedule,
right?
To start with the two best teams in the AFC, the two favorites to meet in the AFC championship game in January, and you got to start with them back-to-back. So even a 2-0 Pittsburgh team, as absurd as it sounds, is a drop in class, because I think everybody considers them a level below, certainly a team that can make the playoffs. But it's a little bit of a drop down in competition for the Texans. And look, the schedule is manageable, and I kind of looked at it early in the season. I thought, if they could maybe be 2-2 or 2-3 through 5 games, it's still manageable. This team does have issues on defense, as we talked about on Sunday, but I don't disagree with the line move necessarily.
All right, and last football point here to throw at you, because you mentioned Denver. Denver catching 6, total of 43.5. In your mind, because I don't think there's really any in mine, the difference between Drew Lock and Jeff Driscoll, because I don't think there is a change between in terms of, like, right, the number getting a little worse. And in fact, I think there's an argument that Driscoll might even be a little bit better than Drew Lock at this point, Wes.
Well, he's certainly a better runner and better at, I think, improvising and making plays with his legs. And I thought he did a nice job hanging in there, coming cold off the bench in Pittsburgh, and actually gave him a chance to come back and pull the upset. Initial look on this game, the number seems right. I'm leaning a little bit more to the under at 43.5. I know Tampa Bay, the explosive offense, and they got that over late. So people are usually a little bit skittish to bet an under when a team is never out of it, in terms, like they say, it's not over until it's over. And Tampa Bay certainly proved that last week, but with some film and a week to game plan, Tampa Bay's front 7 is very good. One of the best in football. The secondary is still a work in progress and needs to be developed. But I think with the week to prep, it's going to be a little bit tough, and Denver's banged up on offense with Lindsey, if he can come back, Sutton. They got a lot of injuries at the skill position. So this might be a lower scoring game. And then I think maybe Denver's defense is good enough to at least somewhat contain Tom Brady. And this offense is still working through some kinks down in Tampa Bay.
All right, let's switch over to golf. First up, Wingfoot, a quick recap of what we saw. So Bryson DeChambeau not only wins the U.S. Open 6-under, the only golfer to finish under par, very consistent through his 4 rounds of play. You know, I'm curious, what happened to Matthew Wolf in your mind when you watched that? Was that pressure, or was that part of his game kind of catching up with him on Sunday?
Yeah, I think it probably was. Keep in mind, Matthew Wolf is only 21 years old. He's still the reigning NCAA champion, because there was no NCAA championship here in 2020 due to the pandemic. He is still just 21 years old. He's now played in 2 majors, JVT. He was 4th at the PGA and was 2nd at the U.S. Open. His prices are going to be absolutely slashed for the Masters in November. I may like him at the Masters, but it may be the April Masters and not the November Masters. A debutant has not won at Augusta since Fuzzy Zeller back in 1979. So a lot of people are going to want to bet him, maybe hold off a little bit. And I actually still got a decision to make because he's so hot right now. But being a two-shot leader after 54 holes, there is a lot of pressure. And even a young, talented guy like Wolf, that's some tall cotton to tread through. And Bryson was able to catch him. And I thought Bryson, he was who I took on Friday in play at 5-1. I just thought, man, he just has the look of the guy that's going to win this because he was so consistent all across the board and all the various statistics. So, Matthew Wolf will be fine. You're not going to get the 60-1 at the majors though anymore on this guy because the secret is definitely out.
Yeah, you know, like, can you put in perspective for me with Bryson and his win over the weekend? Because, like, just on the surface and watching him play, like, you know, meathead sounds insulting, but, like, just a big dude who's just going to bash the ball, you know, off the tee. Like, his game doesn't scream to me a guy who can be successful in the U.S. Open, and yet, of course, here we are, and he has won it.
Yeah, absolutely. It did kind of – I wasn't really fading DeChambeau going in. I know a lot of guys were, because I didn't really know how to handicap him because he hits it so long. Look, I don't really like this style of golf of just bomb and gouge. I like an overall tee to green game and really testing all the facets. And now he says he's going to bulk up even more for the Masters. So look, fair play to him. He earned the victory, but it's not really my type of golf that I enjoy watching. I think you should have to hit fairways. I mean, the ridiculous thing is he hit 23 of terrible. That's like death at a U.S. Open, but not for this guy. And to be 6 under par, and John Rahm said it, he goes, if somebody goes under par on this golf course over 4 days, they're going to win, and they're going to win by a lot. He certainly did.
Yep. By the way, too, I mean, at least at Augusta, right, the fairways are a little bit more forgiving. You can get away with that in the Masters, can you not?
Yeah, you can. And look, Bryson has now been moved to the favorite at about 10-1, and then some of the lurkers right behind him, Rahm 12-1, Dustin Johnson 12-1. So there has been a minor adjustment. It's one of those things, JBD, and we talked about it earlier this summer, that there are going to be tournaments where Bryson DeChambeau is just going to be on and hit it so far past everybody where he's going to dominate. Now, I don't think he's going to dominate the game. There's just too many good players out there. And we saw that after Detroit. When he won, it's like, oh, he's going to take over the world. And he struggled the next 2 months, with the exception of the PGA. He was nowhere in the FedEx Cup events. And then all of a sudden he drifts up, and if you bought on the drift, you cashed a ticket with him on Sunday.
All right. Wes Reynolds, host of the Green Zone Mandalay Bay, of course, where they broadcast from Saturday and Sunday, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern time. Wes, we got a minute. I know it's done a lot of time. Is there really anything with this tournament coming up this weekend? The field kind of sucks.
Yeah, it's a weaker field. It is a full event, not the alternate event. So full prize money, full FedEx Cup points, Masters invite on the line, 2-year PGA Tour exemption. But this is a week, I think, to take some guys down the board down in the Dominican Republic, and we will be talking about that on Long Shots this evening. Rex Hoggard of the Golf Channel will be our guest, and I'm interested to get Rex's insights, too, in terms of talking to players of what they think of this bomb and gouge DeChambeau, and if they're going to follow this pattern or if they think it's just kind of a fad.
Serve up the softball, and Wes crushes it. Good promotion for Long Shots. Wes, thank you very much, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, you bet, JBT. Thanks for having me.
Again, Wes Reynolds, and make sure you listen to Long Shots, get some good analysis on a tournament that, on the surface, from the field perspective, does not look insanely entertaining, but there's always value to be had. That does it for The Edge. Check out everything, vsin.com/podcast. Great conversation about the National Football League, a recap of Monday night, and, of course, looking ahead to the Eastern and Western Conference Finals in the NBA. Betting across America, coming up next here on vsin.